All right. Was this her right hand or her left? I don't know. Can you tell me anything about it? Did she wear a seal ring? Not that I saw, but... Yes? She had a birthmark on the hand near the thumb. It looked like a little black star. Aaron.
Rashar briefly squeezed his eyes shut, then regarded him with a slightly repelled, slightly fascinated look reserved for aberrations of nature, such as animals born with two heads.
These sounds... I don't care how it sounds. You've thought this kind of thing about her before. I should have trusted myself. She lied. I believed her. I shouldn't have. Aaron, she's dead. Show me the body. I'm worried about you. I'm serious. I don't need soldiers. I'll go to the tundra alone. That's not what I meant. I know, but I'm going. You can't leave in the middle of a war to chase a ghost. I'll be back. The tundra is Valorian territory. Do you understand what they'll do to you if you're caught? You can't hide who you are. That's Scar. You don't need me. You said it yourself. I was joking.
Aaron gave Rashar a copy of the same plans for the miniature cannon he'd given to Sarsine.
I've asked my cousin to oversee production on this. The Harani aren't well enough to fight, but it doesn't require much physical strength to make these, and you can assign the construction of different parts of the mechanism to different people. Even the elderly can make the ammunition. If you start now, you'll have a small arsenal of these weapons by the time I'm back.
You're giving this to me.
I should have given it to you before.
This is the sort of thing people do before they kill themselves.
Aaron shook his head.
Suicide is an undignified way to die.
Rashar drew himself up to his full height. He folded his arms, rippling fingers along the biceps.
I could keep you here by force. In my country, we have laws about making sure crazy people don't hurt themselves.
Aaron said, There is something you can do for me.
I dread to ask.
Can I borrow your ring?
7. The tundra air was white with mist. Through his spyglass, as he crouched behind a stunted bush, boots seeping into cold mud, Aaron saw the dark line of prisoners emerge from behind rocks at the base of the volcanoes. He scanned each prisoner that passed within view. He couldn't see her face. The mist was too thick. They filed through the work camp's open gate. It shut behind them. He waited for nightfall. The temperature plummeted. A wolf howled in the distance. Ilion, the messenger, had warned him about the wolves. He'd shown Aaron a way into the tundra that kept them out of sight of the Valorian road to the work camp. They'd slept by day and traveled by night. Ilion was waiting for Aaron, where they'd stopped to unload their gear and rest the three horses near a shallow lake. Aaron remembered the way Javelin's head had lifted to see him go. Aaron went quiet inside. He stared at the shut gate. He was filled with a tense, solid stillness, the kind that wouldn't let him think about anything other than what he needed to do. It stopped the emotions that had claimed him ever since Roshar's news. It spread like a cold mist over the tarry grief, the elated hope. It kept at bay the feeling that had gutted him and made it impossible to breathe. Remorse. Another wolf called. It was now as dark as it was going to get. He left his cover and made for the volcanoes. At the base of a volcano, whose top disappeared into the greenish half-dark, Aaron scrubbed loose sulfur into his hair. He rubbed the yellow, crumbly, stinking stuff into his face, smudging it along the line of his scar. He caked his hands with it. He rubbed it over Roshar's ring. Aaron's plain clothes were streaked with mud from days of travel. If he could have seen himself, he would have seen a blur of yellow and brown. A man of uncertain age and origin, unless someone looked closely. He prayed that no one would. He went down into the mines. His heartbeat seemed to echo in the tunnel like a drum. He waited for morning. At dawn, when the prisoners came down into the tunnel with pickaxes, Aaron stepped out of the shadows to mingle with them, become one of them. Furtively, he searched their faces. When he didn't see her, He grew terrified that he was too late. A month. He hated himself for it. As he went deeper into the mines, he couldn't bear his thoughts that she was sick, hurt, that she'd been transferred to some other kind of prison. Maybe he was wasting yet more time here while she suffered elsewhere. He couldn't let himself think the worst thought. Kestrel was strong. She could survive this. She could survive anything. But when he saw the slack faces of the other prisoners, their blank stares, their shuffling gait, he wasn't so sure. Fear slid down his spine. There were two Valorian guards down in the mines with him, but they paid little attention. They didn't notice when Aaron took a pickaxe right out of a prisoner's hands. The guards broke their conversation with each other, only when the empty-handed prisoner, wandering like a sleepwalker, tried to dig sulfur out of the rocky walls with his fingers, which bled, nails broken. Out of the corner of his eye, Aaron watched the man's mechanical determination. Aaron kept his head down, his shoulders slumped, and his face as blank, as the guards neared the prisoner and conferred. Then they shrugged. They found the man a pickaxe. Aaron worked. He thought of Kestrel doing this. He drove his axe into the wall, swallowed the bile in his throat. He could not get sick, could not draw attention to himself. But the nausea didn't leave him. Hours might have gone by like this. He couldn't count time passing. The grayish light that filtered down from the tunnel's mouth hadn't changed. But the prisoners did. They went suddenly still. Aaron snatched his axe back in mid-swing. He, too, made himself into a statue. He wondered what they were waiting for. It was water. The guards distributed it. The prisoners' bodies went taut, and they eagerly drank. Aaron imitated them. He swallowed the water. Moments later, his pulse shot up to the sky. He felt too big for his body. He knew, as if from a distance, that he'd been tampered with. The water. He struck the rock with an energy resembling delight. This wasn't right. He told himself that this wasn't right, that this wasn't what he really felt. Yet he lovingly filled his double basket with sulfur. He was going to fail. He'd had a plan. He had come here with a plan. Sweat soaked his shirt, the pieces of the plan scattered, and he became certain only of his failure. "Because of you!" Aaron's hands slowed. He heard Kestrel's voice again, felt the sway of a carriage. First winter. If he put his palm to the carriage window, he'd melt its feathered frost. "Because of you," Kestrel had said. Her mouth had opened beneath his. The knowledge of what Aaron was here to do drove into him and turned like a screw. He became himself again. He wouldn't fail her, not again. The drug faded. It was still there, it grasshoppered in his blood, but his body was almost quiet now, tired. His bones felt loose in their sockets. The guards led him to the surface, where other yellow-coated prisoners waited, too many to count at a glance, enough that they could have overwhelmed the guards even without weapons. And they did have weapons. Axes, some of them. Other prisoners could have grabbed the rocks at their feet. Aaron understood obedience. After the Valorian invasion, it had been easy for him to obey. He saw what happened to people who didn't. He'd been a frightened child. Then he grew and changed, resisted. He got what came next. Blood in the mouth, elsewhere. Sometimes it felt like it was everywhere, in his eyes, too, changing his vision. It coded his thoughts, the taste of things. Once, to prove a point, a horse halter was tightened over his head, an iron bit set between his teeth. After 10 years of slavery, Aaron knew obedience in its many forms. The fear of pain, the gritty promise to oneself of vengeance. Hopelessness. A grinding monotony, broken just often enough by the strap or fist. The way punishment made his master more his master, and him less himself. He'd been prone to defiance, no matter how stupid it was, because he could insist, at least in that moment, on the integrity of his will, unalterable by anyone. But then pain did alter it. Humiliation did. Obedience became a version of despair. but he'd never seen the kind of obedience he witnessed when the guards herded the prisoners into a line. They were cows. They weren't even like people pretending to be animals, which he had seen and had done. There was no question of resistance here on the tundra, no glimmer of hatred. Aaron couldn't imagine Kestrel obeying like this. He couldn't imagine her obeying at all. He strained to see her through the ragged line of prisoners. Was she at the front of the line? Was she so changed that he couldn't recognize her? Was she there at all? A guard reached for Aaron's pickaxe. Aaron's hands jerked back. He wanted to swing the axe and nail it into the guard's throat. The guard peered at him. Aaron forced his fingers to relax. He let the axe go. He lined up like everyone else and was led to the camp. He avoided the food and water served in the yard. He was slowly dribbling soup over his bowl's lip and down into the mud when he saw her. Her back was to him. Her hair was matted. She was so thin that he had to swallow hard. For a moment he believed that he was wrong, that this could not be her. But it was. She was being led to a cell block with the other women. "Look back, please." She didn't. And then he was being led in the opposite direction, his heart shaking inside him. Yet he had to do what he was told. Until, that was, the moment he was inside the men's cell block. He came up behind the nearest guard, wrenched the Valorian's head at an awful angle, and snapped his neck. There were other guards. They came at him. He stung them with Roshar's ring, and they slumped, unconscious, to the ground. Aaron found keys on a fallen guard. He locked up the male prisoners. He stuffed as many as he could into as few cells as possible to save time. The women's cell block was quiet. Most of the prisoners were already in their cells, shadows on the ground. At the end of the hall, a Valorian woman with silver braids saw him. She drew her dagger, opened her mouth to shout. He rushed at her, dodged the dagger, clamped a hand down on her face, and stung her with the ring. Then the keys were in his grip, and Aaron was going cell by cell. He called Kestrel's name in a hoarse whisper. There was no answer. A feeling frothed out of him, an acid mix of dread and hope and desperation. Then he stopped. He saw her sleeping on the dirt. Again her back was to him, but he knew the curve of her spine and the spike of her shoulder and the way her ribs rose and fell. He fumbled with the keys. He kept saying her name. He was begging her to wake up. The same words spilled out of him over and over. He wasn't even sure what he was saying anymore as he came into her cell and touched her cheek and, when she still didn't wake, shifted her body up. Her head tipped back. She slept. Some part of Aaron warned that he was going to have to slap her, that she must wake up, and then another part recoiled at the thought. He wouldn't. He never would. He would kill the person who would. Kestrel. He couldn't even shake her frail shoulders. Kestrel. Her eyes cracked open. He caught his breath. She came awake more fully and saw him. He hadn't allowed himself before to consider the possibility that she'd be like the other prisoners, that her mind would be gone, that there'd be no life in her eyes, and her face would be drained of everything that made her who she was. She wasn't like that. She wasn't. And as Aaron watched her blink and take him in, and saw the mind behind her gaze, he was grateful. The gratitude came hot and flowing, a prayer of thanks to his gods. He cupped her face between his hands. Too rough. Or he believed he must have been too rough, because she recoiled. He was afraid he'd hurt her. But she narrowed her eyes in the wan light, studying him. He saw her confusion, couldn't translate it. She whispered, "Who are you?" Aaron didn't understand until she asked her question again. Understanding arrowed into him. She had no memory of him. She truly had no idea who he was. 8. They stumbled over the tundra. He saw how unnaturally drowsy she was. Her ankles sometimes folded beneath her, as if her body was made of stuffed cloth and she was forcing it to move out of sheer will. "Lean on me,"
he said.
She did, but he could tell that she didn't like it.
Just a bit farther, he said.
Eventually, he carried her. In the green cast dark, she slept against his chest. Aaron's legs were slick with mud when he reached the shores of the lake where he'd left Ilion and the horses. Aaron saw what was left of the camp. His knees nearly buckled. He swore. Kestrel woke. He set her gently down. Then he crouched, burying his face in his hands. Ilion's half-eaten corpse had been dragged from the tent. The horses were gone. Wolves. Aaron remembered hearing them howl the night before. His palms slid from his face. He tried not to think about the terror and pain of Ilion's death, and how this too was his fault. He tried not to think about how long it would take without horses to cover the tundra and the mountains that led into Haran. Kestrel's condition. He glanced at her. The poverty of her frame. The wariness with which she regarded him. The way she was doing so even now.
They might have survived, he said, meaning the horses.
He was speaking quickly.
They'd have run. They'd stay together.
She looked like she might ask something, then her face hardened in suspicion, and Aaron was certain that the only reason she had come with him was because he was a better option than a prison cell. He turned. There was no high ground from which to see. The tundra night was light enough to see Kestrel's face, but too murky to spot three horses wandering. How far away? Much too far, if they were there at all.
Javelin! He called.
The horses were good, but only one of them was intelligent enough to come when called. If Javelin could. Aaron didn't know. He'd never heard of a horse doing that, not from out of sight, not without the bribe of a trade. Aaron thought they were far enough from the camp, and he left most of the guards unconscious, maybe dead. He hadn't taken any care with how deeply he'd driven the ring's stinger. Still, he and Kestrel might have been followed. Shouting wasn't smart. Aaron looked at her. She was fighting sleep. He called again.
Javelin!
He made himself hoarse. He walked as far away from Kestrel as he dared, shouting for the horse. Finally, he came back to her and knelt in the mud where she sat.
Call him, Aaron said. He'll come if you call.
Who will come?
He realized that nothing he'd said provided any context to understand who and what Javelin was, if someone didn't already know. He realized that he'd been hoping that she hadn't meant it in the prison, when she'd asked who Aaron was, and looked at him like he was a dangerous stranger. Part of him had believed that she was pretending not to know him in order to wound him, because he deserved it, and it was clear how much she should hate him now.
Kestrel, he said softly,
and could tell from her expression that she accepted her name but didn't trust it.
Javelin is your horse. You love him. He loves you. If you call, he will come for you. We need him. Please try.
She did. Nothing happened, and the look she gave him, as if he was tricking her, making some mockery she couldn't fathom, made his throat close.
Please, he said. Again.
She hesitated, then did as he asked, though eyeing him the entire time, the way you would a predatory creature. When Aaron heard the thud of hooves in mud, he sagged in relief. Javelin led the other two. One of the mares was limping. Aaron would set a sacrifice to the god of the lost. He swore that he would. Then he looked again at Kestrel, who rose unsteadily to her feet, and he knew he would have to sacrifice to all of his gods. Kestrel went to her horse. Aaron couldn't see her face, which rested against the animal's neck. He didn't see her moment of recognition, but he saw her chest heave. Javelin lipped her hair. She leaned against the horse, as she had not leaned against Aaron, fully, tenderly, trusting.
9.
He unnerved her. She was grateful to him, and didn't argue when he said that they should ride Javelin together and lead the two mares. She saw his worried look, how it assessed her. She knew as well as he did that she was likely to fall asleep in the saddle. Javelin was sturdy enough to bear them both, at least for a while. The plan made sense, but she resented it. It was the way she felt, tucked up against the stranger's chest, cradled by either arm. It was the way her body seemed to know him. Her head swayed. She let herself rest against him. It wasn't right that her body should know this person when her mind didn't. Hazily, she realized that he could tell her any lie he wanted. Her memory was a mouth with the teeth torn out. She kept reaching in, probing the holes, pulling back. It hurt. Yes, any lie. He had saved her, but she didn't know what he wanted from her, or what he might say to get it. His heart beat against her spine. It lulled her, even as she knew that it shouldn't. She slept. In the morning, she got a better look at him. Her mind was clearer, she thought, than it had been in some time. He was building a fire. He slowed, though, when he caught the way her gaze inspected him. He went still. He was dirty all over. She had the fleeting thought that she'd seen him both dirty and clean before. Her gaze traced the long scar, quite visible now that the sulfur had rubbed away. A sort of half-recognition shimmered inside her. But the scar wasn't what made him memorable. His gray eyes flashed to hers. She should remember him. She went over the lines of his face again. Distrust coiled within her. It didn't seem possible that she would have seen a person like this and not remember him. Something was wrong with the awkward claim he'd made after their escape that they were friends. If the tentative way he'd said it hadn't alerted her to its not being wholly true, the way he'd just let her evaluate him, and now waited, breath held, for some judgment, suggested his nervousness. If they were really friends, she wouldn't make him nervous. She felt herself harden. Now he looked hurt, and like he was trying to hide it, as if he'd guessed her thoughts. This, too, she didn't like, how easily he read her. They rode separately. She was on javelin, he rode a mare. The next time they stopped to rest the horses, she came closer to the fire, even though this meant coming closer to him. She was achingly cold. He offered her bread and dried meat. He apologized for it.
I know you're used to better.
Which was a stupid thing to say, given that he just rescued her from a prison.
I'm sorry, he said. That was a stupid thing to say.
When she took the canteen, she couldn't stop herself from doing what she'd done in the morning, which was to sniff the water.
It's not drugged, he told her.
I know, she replied, and thought, from the way his face changed, that he'd seen her disappointment. He kept apologizing. He kept trying to tell her something that she wouldn't let him finish, and when she cut him off, he didn't look remotely like the person who had pulled her across the prison yard and attacked anyone who stood in their way, using that odd, heavy ring on his finger, and then disarming a fallen guard, wielding the stolen dagger as his own, burying it in the next guard's belly.
Please let me explain, he said as they rode.
Fear flickered in her lungs. Her mind felt sore. Though it was dizzying to not know so much, a shrinking thing inside her warned that it'd be much worse to remember.
Leave me alone. Don't you want to know what happened? Why you were there?
She saw his naked misery. She suspected that any explanation he could provide was more for his sake than hers. She wanted to shove him off his horse, make him feel how it was to fall. She was falling. She was plunging through the black nothingness of why and how. She was terrified of what she'd forgotten. She blamed him for not seeing her fear, even as she was determined to hide it. All right, she said. Go ahead. Tell me why. For all his earlier persistence, he now didn't seem to know where to begin.
You were a spy. You were caught.
You're a spy?
Not exactly.
Close enough. So that's why you came for me. That's why you want me to remember. That's what you want from me. Information.
No. Kestrel, we...
If we're friends, how did we meet? His mare tossed her head. He was drawing the reins too tight.
In the market.
That's where, not how. He swallowed.
You...
But she glimpsed the market, the dusty heat of it. She heard a crowd roar and remembered seeing his unscarred face looking at her, his features taut with hatred. "Where are you taking me?" she whispered. Now he saw the fear. She saw him see it. He stopped his horse. Her horse stopped too. He reached to touch her. She flinched away.
Kestrel!
There it was again, his inexplicable hurt.
I'm taking you home.
You know what I think. I think that you could be taking me anywhere. I think that you do want something from me. I think that you are a liar.
She spurred Javelin ahead.
He let her go. He knew that she needed him to survive on the tundra. She couldn't go far. She glanced down at the horse moving beneath her. Javelin. This horse was hers. His name felt right. Little else did. The pink sun lowered in the sky. Mosquitoes rose from the mud. As she rode alongside him, her horse seemed to grow larger and higher. She wasn't doing well. He asked if she was hurt. After she said that she wasn't, he asked again.
Maybe your memory...
He trailed off, and she couldn't stand how hopeful he looked, as if some head injury was the desired cause of everything. His searching gaze made her want to snarl like an animal. By sunset, her body had become almost uncontrollable. The need had been building all day, shuddering inside her. Her stomach cramped. She had the faint certainty that she must have been trained to ride well, or she would have already dropped off her horse. He saw it. He kept slowing the pace, even though she could tell that he wanted to push farther.
"What's wrong?" he asked.
She didn't want to admit that she craved a drug that she'd been forced to take. He guessed it, anyway. He nodded and said,
"They gave it to me, too, yesterday."
Then she really hated him, for guessing, and for thinking he understood the clawing desire for something he'd only tasted once. She kept going until she couldn't see straight, and her stomach was wobbling, heaving. Finally, he grabbed her horse's bridle and dragged them both to a stop. She was sick all over the tundra's moss and bracken. He held her hair away from her face. Some part of her that apparently cared didn't know how he could stand to touch her. He wasn't clean, but she was beyond filthy. He gave her water. She swished it, spat it out, drank, then eyed the canteen in her shaking fingers. She appreciated that he'd come well supplied, for three people, even, but he kept producing things she needed and packing them away when she didn't, and building fires and leading the way and doing everything that she almost wished he wouldn't.
"Why don't you hold on to that?"
He nodded at the canteen. Her fingers tightened around it.
"Don't condescend to me."
He touched his scar.
"I didn't mean to."
She got back on her horse. "Let's go," she told him. Nightfall presented a new set of issues.
"There's only one tent."
He cleared his throat.
"But there are three bedrolls."
He waited to see, she thought, if she'd insist that he sleep outside. But she felt that that would be admitting too much, even as she refused to consider exactly what she would be admitting. So she gave him a curt nod. He didn't build a fire, which made her think he was still worried they might be seen. "We should be traveling by night," she said, "and sleeping by day." He shook his head. He didn't look at her. "I'm wide awake," she insisted.
"You should try to sleep. Things should be normal for you."
This, if the pattern of the day was any proof, should have made her wild with irritation. But his expression as he unloaded the folded tent was slow and heavy. His hands were busy. His eyes, though, were quiet, silver in the dark, shining like water. "All right." She huddled, arms tight around her knees. She tried to stop her bones from rattling. She didn't want to be sick again. She turned so that she wouldn't see him and listened to the sounds of him setting up the tent. Even in the tent, with the heat of him barely an arm's length away, she was desperately cold. She longed for her nighttime drug. She could taste its metallic flavor on her tongue. He'd already given her all the spare clothes he had. That first night, after the horses came, he'd opened a pack near the body of his friend and pulled out a coat. He'd stuffed her limp arms into it. She had recognized that it was his by the way that it smelled. Her own clothes seemed to have been cut from a sack, dun-colored, long sleeves, trousers,
She hadn't been wearing this her whole time in the prison. She'd remembered this as he'd bundled her and she'd drowsed in the gorgeous haze of her nighttime drug. She remembered when her clothes had changed and why. She could still feel the buttons of her dress popping open along her back. A rash of cold and terror as the air hit her skin. The pain. But the drug was soft, and she was sleeping then, and what did clothes matter anyway? Now she was nowhere near asleep. She was a curled worm under a mound of cloth. He'd tucked the second bedroll over her, then got out of his and gave her that, too. There was nothing left for him to give her. His voice came through the dark, hesitant.
"Kestrel."
"I wouldn't be cold if I were asleep," she said through jittering teeth. "I need to sleep." A pause.
"I know you do."
"Give me something to sleep."
"I don't have anything like that."
"Yes, you do."
A longer pause this time.
"I don't."
"You have that ring."
"No."
"Use it."
"No."
"I want you to."
"I don't really know how to use it. It could kill you."
"I don't care." He was angry.
"I do."
She knew why his eyes had been too bright earlier. Her own were stinging. He shifted. She kept her back to him as she felt him move closer. The warmth of him slowly fitted along her spine. It was like sinking into a bath. His words brushed the back of her neck.
"Just to keep you warm," he said,
a question in his tone.
"You say that we are friends?"
"Yes."
"Have we done this before?"
Another pause.
"No."
Her shaking quieted to a shiver. She found that she'd moved even closer to him, had sealed herself against him. His heart beat fast against her back. He held her, and the weight of his arm made her feel more solid, more real, less ready to shatter into mirror-like pieces. She calmed, relaxing into his warmth. She still didn't sleep. Neither did he. She could feel his wakefulness. She thought, fleetingly, that it was like him not to fall asleep before she did. She didn't know how she could believe this to be true. It was hard to reconcile with the one memory she had of him, his face in the market, across the distance. An enemy's mouth, enemy's eyes. But he was here, he had saved her, and he'd asked nothing of her except to remember, and had stopped asking even for that. She knew his scent, knew that she liked it. His hand reached to touch the pulse in her neck. He kept his fingers there, slightly too firm to be gentle, as if he doubted she was alive. Had they really never shared a bed? No, she would remember that. Wouldn't she? There was a musical cry far off, out on the tundra. Wolves. They sounded lonely. Beautiful, though, as they called to each other. In the morning, she discovered that she had, at some point, fallen asleep. It was brutal to be awake. He wasn't in the tent. A feeling jolted her heart. The movement she made then must have been loud.
"I'm here,"
he called from outside the tent, and she emerged to see him in front of the fire that she should have smelled and interpreted as meaning he must be there or nearby. Or she would have, if she hadn't been so afraid that he had left her. She walked to the fire, still stumbling on her feet. She had the frustrated idea that she'd never been especially graceful in her body, but that she'd at least been competent before. She sat across from him. The pale fire leaped between them, snapped. He was no longer wearing the heavy ring. She wondered what he'd done with it, then decided that she wouldn't ask as long as he said nothing about the night before. They sat and ate in silence. He kept looking at the injured mare, the one they didn't ride. She caught him doing it, and knew that he didn't want her to see him doing it. When they stopped later in the day to rest, she held his gaze, just as it was about to flick back to the mare.
"Don't," she said.
"I don't want to."
"How would you, even?"
He shrugged, and she became conscious of the dagger at his hip, the one he'd taken off a prison guard. She recognized the dagger as a sort of thing that should belong to her and not to him. She had a sudden intense feeling of difference. She realized that they'd been speaking in his language, not hers.
She imagined him taking the knife and cutting into the horse's throat. There was no other way to do it. A massive gush of blood, thrashing body, the slide of hooves.
"She's slowing us down."
"I said no." Finally, he nodded. That felt familiar, his obedience. She had commanded him before. But she also thought that he had never obeyed her this way, and that even when he'd appeared to, he hadn't, really. Definitely not friends. Something else. That night was like the one before. He held her. She warmed. Her limbs softened. It seemed to be the only thing that could possibly make her sleep. He said,
"You bought me."
"What?" He had murmured the words against the nape of her neck. His voice came again, stronger this time.
"You asked how we met. It was in the market. I was for sale. You bought me."
Instinct told her to turn in his arms and search his face to see what expression it showed. She didn't trust her instincts. She stayed very still. "Why would I do that?"
"I don't know."
"Do I still own you?" The wind pushed against the tent's canvas.
"Yes."
Her reply was blunt.
"No one would believe the things you say.
Do you think having no memory makes me a fool?"
"No."
"You say that I was your spy, which means that I worked for you. You say that I own you, which means that you work for me. You say that we are friends. Masters and slaves are not friends. And then there is this..."
She broke off, unwilling to go any further. She was too aware of his heat next to her.
"You say impossible things. I don't believe you."
His ribs expanded, hard wings against her back.
"If you let me explain..."
"Stop talking! Stop talking! I don't want to hear your voice."
He fell silent. She lay rigid against him, wishing that she could make herself pull away. At an uncertain hour of the night, she felt him draw breath. He was going to try again to explain, she thought. She went stony with panic. Again she had that sense of falling, hurtling toward what she didn't remember, the skull-crushing impact. She didn't want him to speak. She was suddenly not even sure he meant to speak. It occurred to her, strangely, that he might sing.
"Don't!"
Her command was sharp. He didn't. Later, she woke because she was shaking again. He was gone. It was still nighttime. He should not be gone. She pushed out of the tent and saw him standing beneath an imaginary sky. Above the darkness, beyond the needlepoint stars, were swirls of green and pink, edged with violet. She was sure she'd never seen anything like it. He turned to meet her gaze, which had lowered from the sky to him. She didn't understand how he wasn't freezing. Then she saw the way his shoulders hunched and realized that he was. He looked back up at the night's gauzy colors.
"What is that?" she asked.
"The gods."
"They don't exist."
She wasn't sure how she knew that, but she knew that she believed it.
"They do. They've come to punish me."
"It was you," she said,
giving voice to her lurking suspicion, and knowing, as his face twisted, that she was right.
"You're the reason I was in that prison."
He met her eyes.
"Yes."
10. Aaron wasn't sure how they made it home. Kestrel had worsened. She was sick during the day. At night, her body became a silently keening thing. He would hold her, worried that it was wrong of him, even, sometimes especially, when she seemed to welcome it. Then it was as if a wave washed through her and pushed her out into sleep. He felt her go and became wrenchingly grateful, while knowing that whatever comfort he could offer was something she didn't actually want. She refused to let him help her inside his house. The glowing summer day did little to warm her. She huddled inside his dirty coat, and their progress up the path to the house was slow enough that by the time they reached the main entrance, the entire household had gathered to see them. Kestrel kept her eyes on her unsteady feet, but Aaron knew that she was aware of the crowd. Her mouth had set into a grim line. Rashar came to them first, boots crunching on the gravel.
He was uncharacteristically silent, appalled, when he wasn't someone given to being appalled by the appearance of others.
"I want Sarsine,"
Aaron told him, but Sarsine was already there. Kestrel eyed her, a moment's worth of hesitation. Then she accepted Sarsine's arm, and Aaron had to hide the sting of what could be nothing other than hurt jealousy, after which he had to hide his shame at such a petty feeling. He trailed after them, hands upsettingly empty. He wasn't ready to be useless. He had at least been useful on the tundra. Aaron followed them up the stairs to the east wing, where Sarsine opened the door to the suite where Kestrel had once stayed. When they entered, Aaron searched Kestrel's face for some sign of recognition. She kept her gaze averted from his in a way that showed that she knew she was being scrutinized, and why. Sarsine settled Kestrel onto the nearest soft chair and knelt before her, removing the battered shoes that were barely recognizable as having once been a lady's slippers. Her expression flickering, Kestrel studied Sarsine's dark, bent head. Kestrel's voice, which he'd used less and less in the past few days, was hoarse.
"Are you my maid?"
His cousin flinched. He saw Kestrel realize that she'd said something wrong. Sarsine looked to him. He leaned and whispered in her ear. Sarsine set the shoes down in a neat pair. "Yes," she finally said. "I will be for now, if you like." She rose and began to peel the coat off Kestrel. Something that Aaron had tried to wind tightly inside him during the days on the tundra began to unwind. He wasn't sure what was going to happen when it came undone. He would have said, if he could have said anything at all, that what he felt was like the desolate trembling that seized Kestrel's body at night. Sarsine caught his eye, lifted her brows. She had paused in the removal of Kestrel's clothes. Her message was clear. He nodded. He should leave. Of course he should. Yet he couldn't make himself move.
"Aaron!"
Sarsine was stern now. He turned, but hadn't gotten far when he heard Sarsine's sucked breath. He glanced back. His eyes went wide. He was next to them before he was aware of having taken a step. His hand snatched the loose cloth of Kestrel's shirt at the shoulder. He saw it, the red welt that slashed down her shoulder blade. She jerked away from his grasp. The cloth tore. Not much. Enough.
"Aaron!"
Sarsine. He saw more. He saw how the lashes looked like his own, how they had sliced her skin and went out of his sight under the cloth. He knew it was all over her back.
"I asked you."
His voice was wretched.
"I asked you if you were hurt."
"I'm not. It's healed."
"But you were."
"I didn't remember."
He didn't believe her.
"How could this happen to you? How could you not tell me?"
He had pulled her to her feet. He was holding her by the upper arms. There was no flesh there. His thumbs met bone. He was not himself. This was not his world. There was no version of his world where this could be real.
"You're frightening her," Sarsine said.
Not fear. Kestrel's face was a blazing challenge, chin lifted, shoulders tight, shirt loose at the neck. One of the lashes had curled up over her collarbone. She tugged free. His throat was tight.
"You should have told me."
"I don't have to tell you anything."
"Kestrel, you did something for me, for this country. Don't you remember? Can't you try? Or let me tell you, please."
Her flat palm cracked across his face. It sucked the air out of him. His cheek burned. She caught him across the mouth, too. Her eyes were liquid and golden and lost and angry. He was too ashamed of himself to speak. Gently, Sarsine said,
"I know you want to help." "Of course I do," he whispered.
"Then you need to leave." It wasn't until he was alone in the hallway, sagged against the wall, that he touched where she had hit him. His fingers came away wet. He stared at the tears. They shone on his fingertips like blood. 11.
"Will she die?"
Sarsine shut the door to Kestrel's suite behind her with more force than necessary. Hands planted on her hips, She stared down at Aaron where he sat in the hallway, back to the wall opposite Kestrel's door. His joints were stiff. He didn't know how long he'd been sitting there. "Gods, Aaron, pull yourself together. No, she won't die."
"The lashes. There could be an infection, a fever."
"There isn't."
"It happens to me."
"She's not you."
"She can't keep anything down. It's gotten worse."
"She was drugged twice a day, every day, for about a month. Some of what she's going through is because her body wants the drugs it can't have." He caught the plural form.
"More than one kind?"
Though he'd already suspected this from his own experience with the exhilarating power of the drug he'd been given in the mines, and the way Kestrel longed for something to make her sleep, had begged for it sometimes. "Yes."
"She told you this."
Hurt pinched his heart. He looked away from his cousin, so that she wouldn't see how it felt that Kestrel had so easily told her what he'd been forced to guess. He was in the tent again, on the tundra, listening to the wind buckle the canvas, the chill oozing up from the ground, Kestrel in his arms, his pulse wild, the awful shudder of her limbs, the curve of her neck in the dim green dark. The relief to hear, finally, her breath slow and quiet, the way his own breath stayed uneven for a long time after that. He said,
"How did you get her to fall asleep?"
"She's not asleep."
"What?"
"She's calm enough for now."
"You left her alone, awake?"
He remembered how she'd stood in a small boat, high over black water, on the night of the first winter rebellion, ready to jump. He heard her asking for Rashar's numbing ring.
"You can't go back. Sarcine, you can't leave her alone."
His cousin's hands slid down from her hips. Her stance loosened, her expression growing soft and tired. "Kestrel's too strong to do what you are thinking."
"Look at her."
Aaron spoke as if Kestrel were in the hallway with them.
"Look at what I've done," he almost said,
then bit back the words. Sarcine would only say that none of this was his fault. He knew the truth. Sarcine sat on the floor across from him, knees drawn up beneath her muslin skirts. "I have looked at her. I've bathed and dressed her and put her to bed, and she's malnourished and sick, but she's alive. She's fought hard to live. If you don't think she's strong, you're mistaken."
"I'll stay with her."
Sarcine slowly shook her head. "She doesn't want you."
"I don't care."
"She won't hurt herself."
"You don't know that."
"Aaron, I'll care for her, of course, but we can't be with her every moment of the day."
"I damned well can."
"She would hate it. She doesn't even know who she is anymore. How can she find out if she's never alone with herself?" Aaron tunneled his fingers through his dirty hair and pressed the heels of his hands into his closed eyes until they flashed white under the lids.
"I know who she is."
"Proud girl, hard, noble heart, and a liar, a liar."
"I should have known."
Every moment with her in the capital rushed through him, freezing his veins. He'd swallowed her lies, the way she'd mocked him, set him aside, made him insignificant. It had been easy to believe. It had made sense. He cursed himself. He saw the opportunities he'd had over many months before her arrest to seize the truth of things. But none of what he'd seen or suspected in the capital had made sense. It had been senseless, so apparently wrong, the way he'd seen her eyes slim with longing when he'd found her by a canal. The waters had swelled below. She'd worn a maid's dress. Senseless, that she would gamble her safety to help someone else's people. Senseless, that she'd smuggle information to Aaron's spymaster, a traitor to her country. The Valorian punishment for treason was death. And Aaron had accused her of selfishness. In the capital, he'd thought words like power-hungry and shallow and cruel. He'd said as much to her face. He'd blamed her for the deaths of the Eastern Plains people. Her stricken expression, clear in the rushlights of that filthy tavern, the white line of her mouth. He had ignored it, misread it. He'd missed everything that had mattered. Sarcine grabbed his wrists and tugged the hands from his eyes. He looked at her but didn't see her. He saw Kestrel's wasted face. He saw himself as a child, the night of the invasion, soldiers in his home, how he had done nothing.
Later,
he told Sarsin when the messenger had come to see him.
No, I won't,
he'd promised Rashar when the prince had listed reasons not to rescue the nameless spy from the Tundra's prison.
I was wrong, Arryn said. I should have.
Your should-haves are gone. They belong to the god of the lost. What I want to know is what you are going to do now. He had long avoided the general's estate. Sarsin's words ringing through his head, Arryn rode Javelin through the unlocked gate. A yellow-throated thrush called from a low bough. The uncut grass of the meadow reached up to the horse's hocks. Arryn walked Javelin through the green hiss of it, away from the villa, which he wasn't yet ready to see, and up a hill, through a grove daubed with small, ripening oranges. They'd be hard and dry if he plucked and peeled them. Not ready yet, but their scent made him want them now. He made a clicking sound with his teeth and tongue, nudged the horse with his heels. Javelin flicked an ear and picked up the pace, gusting a short breath through his nostrils, pleased to go more quickly. Arryn kept clear of the larger outbuildings, the thatched cottage that had belonged to Kestrel's nurse, just west of the overgrown garden, the empty stables, the empty slaves' quarters, the windowless barn-like shape of it, the paint white and flaking in the sun. Arryn kept Javelin on his determined path, but turned a little in the saddle for a backward glance at the last building, his sword shifting against his hip as he did so. He reached the forge and swung off the saddle, dropped his boots to the ground. He loosened the stallion's girth and let him go. The grass was high and good, a horse's heaven. Arryn's boots were loud on the flagstones. There were smithies in the city he could have used, but this one, perversely, felt like his. Things were as Arryn had left them last winter. Inside, tools hung where they should. The anvil had a skin of dust. The hearth was long dead. The coal scuttle full. He built a fire in the forge, worked the bellows, and watched flames snap to life. When it was going strong, he left the fire to burn. He'd be back. The fire would have to burn a while for what he wanted. In the meantime, he forced himself to think it. He should go see the house. The general's villa, Kestrel's, had stood empty since Arryn had killed Cheat last winter. As the leader of the Harani rebellion, Cheat had claimed the house as his, and lived there because it was the best, and because it was the general's. Maybe even because it was Kestrel's. Arryn didn't know when Cheat's malevolent fascination with her had begun. Arryn swallowed hard to remember it. His hand was tight on the sword's hilt. He looked at his clenched knuckles, looked again at his father's sword, pulling out an inch of it to see the gleam of finely tempered steel in the sun. Then he dropped it back home into the scabbard, and he went inside the house. Past the portico, the entryway's fountain was silent and scummed over. Bugs walked the water's green surface. Painted gods stared down at Arryn from the walls. Other creatures, too. Fawns, a leaping stag, birds. He caught a glimpse of one frescoed bird, arrested in mid-flight, and remembered seeing it for the first time over Kestrel's shoulder, on the day that she'd bought him. Inside, the house was mostly bare. He'd thought it would be, but he never thought that it would look like this. After Arryn had signed the imperial treaty that seemed to promise Harran freedom, the Valorian colonists surrendered their homes in this territory. Ships came to empty the houses of Valorian possessions. There were disputes over whose was what. Arryn had waded in, brokered the negotiations, but had ignored Kestrel's house. The Harani family who'd owned it was long dead. When a Valorian ship entered the harbor to empty the general's villa, Arryn pretended that the ship and house didn't exist. He'd assumed that everything had been taken. He was almost right. He hadn't been here since the first winter rebellion. He hadn't wanted to be drawn to Kestrel's rooms, or to see the kitchens where his people had been forced to work, or to find the place where the steward accused him of touching something he shouldn't have. A flogging had followed, set far back on the grounds so that no one in the house would be bothered by unpleasant sounds. Arryn hadn't wanted to remember the music room ringing with Kestrel's playing, or to see the library where he'd once shut himself inside with her. He'd wanted nothing of this place at all. Even when he'd come with men and a cart and draft horses to bring the piano to his house, Aaron hadn't gone inside. He'd waited outside, rigging a system of pulleys he used to help haul the instrument up and onto the cart after it had been wheeled out the wide doors of the music room. So he wasn't prepared for the filth he saw and smelled. Cheat had been vengeful. The corners reeked of piss. There were stains on the walls, the windows. Several panes were shattered. Aaron's feet carried him swiftly to the music room. Things were odd there. Leaves of sheet music scattered on the floor. Some of it burned, but only a little, as if Cheat had started and then had had a better idea. Probably the same idea that had kept him from ruining the piano. Maybe Cheat hadn't been sure whether to force Kestrel to do what he wanted, or bribe her. Aaron's stomach seized. His lungs blazed. He flung open a window. He stared into the garden, remembering this view. He'd watched flowers dip and float in a breeze while Kestrel played a melody written for the flute. His mother used to sing along to it in the evenings for guests. He wondered if this was what it meant to have been born in the year of the god of death, to see everything defiled. But the air cleared his head. He made his way to the kitchens. There he started yet another fire, this time to boil water. He found a harsh-smelling block of lye, rags, buckets, orange-scented wood oil, vinegar for the windows and walls. Aaron began to clean the house from top to bottom. As he wrung out a cloth, he felt his god sneer.
"Cleaning? Ah, Aaron, this is not why I made you. This is not our agreement."
Aaron had no sense of having agreed to anything, only of having been claimed and liking it. He couldn't dishonor his god, but he also couldn't dishonor himself. He pushed the voice from his head and kept at his task. When he returned to the forge, the fire was long dead. He restarted it and stoked the flames. Then he set his father's sword into the fire, heated it to the point of flexibility, and held it against the anvil. He chopped the blade. His mind was quiet as he trimmed it down, and something new formed beneath his hands. Folded steel, layer upon layer. Forge welded. Shorter, thinner, strong and sprung. He reformed the hilt, shaped and ground the blade. He did all that he could to make Kestrel's dagger his finest work. 12. She swam out of the murk. She was sore, shoulders and ribs and stomach especially, but the spasms that had racked her body were gone. Everything was impossibly soft. The feather bed, her thin shift, clean skin, the tender give of the pillow beneath her cheek. She blinked, heard the short sweep of her eyelashes against the pillow's fabric. Her hair lay loose, smooth. It had been disgusting when she'd arrived here. She remembered Sarsine working oiled fingers through it. "Cut it off," Kestrel had said. She'd felt disjointed and eerie as the words left her dry lips, like she wasn't really speaking but echoing something she'd already said. "Oh, no," Sarsine had replied. "Not this time." Cut it off. Yes, there had been another time. Then there'd been a tangle of myriad little braids beneath her fingers, and she'd hated the feel of them, because of the ghost of an unexpected pleasure. Yet what kind of pleasure, and why it had vanished, her mind refused to say. "You might regret cutting your hair, a society lady like you," Sarsine had said in this other, earlier time. "Please, I can't bear it." Sarsine unsnarled the dense clumps left by the prison camp. The movement of fingers in Kestrel's hair made her dizzy. She'd gagged and was sick all over again. Now, puzzling through this, Kestrel touched a ribbon of hair on the pillow. She'd lost track of its color in the prison. Familiar, dark blonde, a little reddish. It had been a more fiery hue when she was little.
"Warrior red," her father had said, tweaking a braid.
She suspected that he'd been disappointed to see it darken over time. She sat up, too swiftly. Her sight dimmed. She got lightheaded. "Ah," said a voice. Her vision cleared. Sarsine stretched up from a chair, dove-gray wood, upholstery the color of matte pearl. This, too, familiar, and padded to a small table that held a covered tureen. Sarsine ladled steaming broth into a cup and brought it to her. "Hungry?"